How many of you have memorized our memory verse to this point? Start to raise your hand. Psalm 33:12. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, and the people whom he hath chosen for his inheritance. A good verse to memorize, a good verse to know, and the Lord blesses the nation that honors him, and I think that's why we're in the problem. We're in trouble like we're in right now. A lot of thought as to who's causing the problems. I can tell you exactly who's causing the problem. The Lord is. You try to find which group or which philosophy is responsible for the problems in America. There's no such thing as a group responsible for the philosophy. You can find groups all over this country pointing fingers at one another, saying this is the problem. If we get rid of this group, if we get rid of that, we'd be all right. That's a lie. And usually the group pointing the finger is the group that's the worst one in the bunch. The problem with this country is the Lord. You want to know where the problems are coming from? The Lord. And the fact of the matter is, blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord. We left off following the Lord. And when we left off following the Lord, when we left off his principles, when we left off his ideals, he started to work on us. And one of the best things God does is not to shoot lightning bolts down and fry people in the streets, you know, and all that. One of the best things the Lord does to let man know what he's all about is just take his hand off. And that's what God's done. I remember a preacher talking, it's been several months ago when he was here, about the Challenger explosion. And somebody said, that's God showing us what he can do. You know, God just slapped that Challenger and exploded. He said, no, it's not happening. God just took his hand off. God show you how long man's technology will work without God's intervention. Man's technology and all of his ability is good for about a minute and 34 seconds before it explodes and blows everything sky high. And God just taking his hand off this nation. We were in a discussion yesterday, several preachers over in Indiana where I was in a meeting, and we were talking about the implications of the scandal, the newest scandal in the White House now, and the subpoena of White House staff and the subpoena even of trash and the trash cans. And they said, boy, they're finally going after him. And somebody remarked, well, if they do get him, what good does it do us? I mean, we got to take Gore. And if they get Gore, we get Foley. I said, well, if we dig low enough, we're going to get, you know, some fellas that, we get Ross Dinkowski or Packwood, you know. It doesn't matter how far down you dig, the system is corrupt. And the problem is we left off serving the Lord. And when we left off serving the Lord said, all right, America, I'll give you just what you want. You want a nation void of God and void of God's influence and void of morality? That's what I'll give you. And that's what you got. That's what you got. My father used to joke. He used to say we ought to vote Washington dry. And he wasn't talking about alcohol. He said we just vote everybody out of office and let it run on autopilot for 8 or 10 years. There's enough bureaucracy up there to last 8 or 10 years. And matter of fact, I ought to read that to you. Brother Mark, can we get my keys if you can find this? I doubt if you can find it because I don't really know where it is. I think it's laying right on the front of my desk. It's on a little sheet of paper, and it's out of a laser printer, and it's got an article down it. There's two articles. The bottom one is about a new element found at a state university. If you can find that, bring it to me, all right? All right, we're back to history again. We're back at the 1600s, the early 1600s. We remarked, and we want to review a lot today, about the distinction between the Puritans and the Pilgrims. The Pilgrims were separatists. The Puritans sought to purify the Anglican Church from within. The only distinction between the Anglican Church and the Catholic Church in England or in Europe at this time is that the Anglican Church does not bow to the supremacy of the Pope. That's basically the only point there's an objection at. And they will not subject themselves to the supremacy of the papacy. They will not allow the papacy to rule over the affairs of England, not only religious but civil. Boy, you did good. Oh, you want to raise, I'll double your salary. Remember that, Brother Jackson, twice nothing, he gets that. This is more on a lighter note, so disregard everything I just said. We'll go back and get this done, then we'll get in earnest about history. It says a new element has been discovered. The heaviest element known to science was recently discovered by physicists at the State University Laboratory. The element, tentatively named administratium, has no protons or electrons and thus has an atomic number of zero. However, it does have one neutron, 125 assistant neutrons, 75 vice neutrons, and 100 assistant vice neutrons. This gives it an atomic mass of 301. These 301 particles are held together in a nucleus by a force that involves the continuous exchange of meson-like particles called morons. Since it has no electrons, administratium is inert. However, it can be detected as it impedes or stops every reaction it comes in contact with. According to its discoverer, a small amount of administratium caused one reaction to take 4 days to complete when normally it would have occurred in 1 hour. Administratium has a normal lifespan of 3 years, at which time it does not die out but actually undergoes a reorganization in which the assistant neutrons, vice neutrons, and assistant vice neutrons exchange places. Some studies have shown that the atomic weight actually increases after such reorganization. Research indicates that administratium tends to concentrate in areas such as government agencies, large corporations, universities, and can be found in the newest, best-maintained buildings. If allowed to accumulate, it can destroy productive reasoning. Administratium can be controlled to prevent irreversible damaging, but its results are not promising. So there you go. That's what we got in Washington, is called administratium. Now then, back to where we were a minute ago. Now shift back into serious mode. The Puritans and the Pilgrims. The Puritans sought to purify the Anglican Church. They wanted to correct the corruptions that were there. They sought accomplish that by means of working within the system. The Separatists or the Pilgrims did not see any use in staying with the system, they were the ones that said that there is no head of the church save Jesus Christ, and anyone that places himself as head of the church is usurping God's authority and is in essence the Antichrist, because that's Christ's rightful position according to Ephesians chapter 2. He is the head of the church. So the argument was waged. The Pilgrims left, first of all, Holland and then England to come to America to flee the growing persecution that was waged against them. They left Leiden in Holland and came to England and then changed ships and came to America. They were fleeing persecution. They were very poor people. They had not a lot of clout politically, nor did they have a lot of finances. They were very weak and very unimportant as far as civil matters went. They did not represent a great block of people to contend with, so persecution was waged against them. They came to America to establish the colony in 1620 that we call Plymouth. Now, at that point in 1620, the Puritans were pretty well happy with where they were. They were not highly respected, but they had a lot of money. The Puritans represented a faction of English aristocracy, meaning that there were some lords and some barons and some of those guys that comprised the makeup of the Puritan people throughout England. They had holdings. They ran businesses. They had finances and lands. They were not the paupers that the Separatists were. And so because of that, you know, money in your pocket tends to make you willing to accept a little more. They were willing to abide some of the problems in the Anglican Church. They maintained their connection with the Anglican Church and again sought to change from within. At the ascension to the throne of Charles I, things changed. Charles I's first move was to appoint a new Archbishop of London, and the Archbishop of London made sure that the king would only elect those Orthodox individuals within the Anglican Church to positions of high authority. He notified the king who the Puritans were and who the people were that were not to be counted for any type of position in the church, and therefore began what later on was known as the Great Migration, was the persecution now of the Puritans. And we need to bear in mind, you know, when they start persecuting the little guys. I don't agree with the Jehovah's Witnesses, I'll be honest with you, but I believe in religious freedom. And I'd fight just as hard to protect the religious freedom of Jehovah's Witnesses as I would independent Baptists. Because if you're not careful, before long, they come knocking on your door. I think it was Pastor Niemöller, was the Lutheran pastor in Germany, that talked about how when the Nazis came for this group, nobody said much because it was a small group. And then when they came for this group, nobody said much because they were leaving them alone. And he said, after a while, when they came for us, there was nobody else to say anything. And the truth of the matter is, religious liberty often involves you having to get along with some people you may not care for. That's what makes this country great. I don't have to agree with you theologically. As a matter of fact, I can stand in my pulpit and preach against you. And I do. There are a lot of churches that I preach against from this pulpit that I would gladly die to defend their right to believe what they believe. You say, I don't understand that. That's what Christianity is all about. And that's what religious liberty is all about. I don't want the Baptists ever to gain control of America. God help us. You think it's bad in Washington now. If the Baptist church ran this country, it would be belly up, flop, bankrupt, and destitute in 24 hours. That's about as long as it'd take the Baptists to mess it up. If you don't believe that, look at the Baptist churches. I mean, it would take 15 minutes after the president was sworn in office, he'd call out the National Guard and start shooting everybody else. It'd be a mess. I believe in religious liberty. What does that mean? I mean, you've got liberty to teach, preach, and believe what you want to believe, and propagate it. There's a growing movement now called an anti-propagation movement in this country, which says you can believe all you want to believe, just don't tell anybody about it. And the statement is, well, you know, if somebody is born into a religion, then you shouldn't try to convert them from that religion. Why? They didn't choose it. And if they did choose it, if it's wrong, why shouldn't I tell them the truth? That's like Clinton's health care plan. You're going to be born one day, and when you're born, you're assigned a doctor, and it's illegal for you to go find another doctor. And if the guy's a quack, it doesn't make any difference. There's liberty. The Puritans decide that their fate is inevitable, that their ability to work within the system is fast being impeded, and they are not going to be able to accomplish the reforms that they desire to accomplish, and therefore, because they have some wealth, because they are represented by a number of individuals who are businessmen and that type of thing, they don't turn tail and run, but they began to formulate a very carefully concocted plan. Now, it's important that you realize this, because the Puritans, by and large, are the ones that settled this nation. The Pilgrims have the first colony, but it is the Puritans that establish this nation and bring it into existence. The Puritans establish a plan by which they will assume control of a defunct agency. Now, let me explain to you again what these agencies did, like the Virginia Company and the New England Company. They were the ones who were basically made up of private entrepreneurs who financed expeditions and founded colonies in this new world. The king would grant them a charter. He would assign them so much land, and they would have a right to go and settle that land. And what they would then turn around to a group of people such as this, and they would say, listen, if you wanted to go over there on a ship and finance your own expedition, it would cost you $30,000 to establish keep housekeeping in the new world. What we'll do is, if you can come up with $5,000, we'll finance that other 20, sound like carpet sales, doesn't it? Car sales, whatever. Just the same thing going on today. We'll finance another $25,000, and you in turn will become indentured to us for a period of 7 to whatever the agreed period of time was, normally 7 years, at which time all of the profits that you make in the crops that you plant and the things that you produce, all the profits will belong to us. At the end of 7 years, then the lands are taken, and for every share you buy, $5,000, we will divide that land up among the shares, and you'll become the landowners. Now, that's what a company was all about. That's how they made their money. They produced profits for those who invested in the company. Now then, Most of those companies had gone bankrupt. We talked about the Virginia Company and the colony that failed at Roanoke, and then the massive death at Jamestown. The problem was you didn't have anybody who wanted to come to America because of the fact that death was almost certain. Jamestown's mortality rate or death rate was 90% several years. So you ran a 9-to-1 odds that you were going to die if you came to this country. Who would want to put up $5,000 of their own money to, you know, inherit a 9-to-1 shot you were going to die? They wrote several pamphlets that were exposed as out-and-out lies, talking about the new land and how wonderful and how fertile it was. You know, and you hear the songs, you know, for oh beautiful, you know, for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain. It wasn't that way when these people were arriving. It was not pleasant joy and stretch your hammock between two trees out on the bay and enjoy life. It wasn't that at all. It was a life of hardships. I read several years ago from a book that was discovered down. My wife is from central Ohio, down around Piqua and Versailles, Ohio. And they found a book in an attic that had come from a young girl from Germany, one of the first settlers, as near as they can understand, to come across the state of Ohio years ago, back in the 1700s. And she kept a diary. And it laid for years in an attic with somebody's papers from their family and memorabilia. And finally, they took it down and had it translated. And she talked about coming through the state of Ohio in groups of people that were migrating westward and said that for several days at a time, they would go without seeing the sun because of the denseness of the forest. I mean, you drive from here down to Piqua now, you don't see anything but flat, desolate land. I hate flat land. I despise it. I mean, I realize you got to have farmers, and farmers, I appreciate what you do, but I hate flat land. I like mountains and hills. I went through Kansas one time, and I remember we looked at the map as we headed across Kansas. We were going east to west, and there on the map, you could see one little S turn in the interstate about halfway across Kansas. And I kid you not, we knew when we got there. Because the road just went straight as an arrow. It didn't move. It didn't turn. When we started, I said, well, here we are. I know where we are on the map. And you could look, if there hadn't been a haze, you could have seen forever. I despise flat land. I like forests, dense trees. I like mountains. I like hills and valleys. I love all of those things. You say, why are you in Toledo? The Lord constrains me. But she said as they came through here, the forest was so dense that when they wanted to build a cabin, they would simply cut the logs, and where the first logs fell, that's where they would put the other logs on top to build a cabin. You couldn't move them around. And they would clear a patch of land large enough to put a house and a garden and pray that by the next spring the forest would not have encroached back and claimed that land again because they would die. And you, as we drive down through Ohio, we're looking at a process of several, probably 100, 150, 200 years of clearing and cultivation that's produced what we've got here. And yet we tend to think, well, you know, when they got to this country, that's what it was like, you know, just we get this Dances with Wolves picture in our mind. This guy riding out there on his horse. Did you ever wonder where he got water from? Journeying out there across those beautiful prairies. Did you ever wonder what happened when they came across a prairie fire? You talk about fires in California, they're trying to put those out. What about the ones nobody tried to put out? You and I here, when we get to this part of our history, we live in the Wild West. There's nothing they can say about the Sioux and the Apaches out west that could hold a candle to what took place right here in this area of the United States. Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, this were some of the most fierce Indian fighting that ever took place. And you're talking forests and hills and crags and valleys. This is where it was fought right here. It's exciting to live here to remember what took place. Now, what I'm saying is when these people arrived here, they weren't met with open arms. As a matter of fact, when they arrived, oftentimes they were hated immediately. Because when they arrived with no support, they arrived with no supplies, and very oftentimes they arrived with no food. which meant that the people that lived here were now going to have to take care of other people. They couldn't just get off the boat and look for the local inn in which to stay. There was no local inn. Oftentimes there were 8 or 10 little cabins that comprised the settlement. And those cabins sometimes were as small as 8 by 10 on the inside, where a family of 6 or 7 would live. And that included living space and kitchen and bedroom, and that's all the space they had. Sometimes if they could have pitched their roofs a little higher, they put a small loft upstairs where the kids could sleep. And when a ship would arrive with new settlers on board, those families would have to take those other families into their homes and allow them a place to stay till they could build their own place to stay. So I'm trying to give you a picture this morning of what people faced when they came to America. Was not the, you know, let's get away from it, honey, type lifestyle. Let's sell our job and move to the Caribbean. Was not that kind of lifestyle at all. Nobody wanted to come. You say, why is that important? God protecting again. God protecting. And finally, the Puritans said, here's what we'll do. They took over the defunct New England Company. In other words, they had gone bankrupt. Nobody wanted to come, and so they had gone bankrupt. And what they did is they were allowed to take the charter of the New England Company, and they formed it into the Massachusetts Bay Company. They went to King Charles of England and sought for a charter for this new company, or this assumed company, and King Charles granted it. The only thing that was a problem that he did not realize at that time is that charter did not specifically state where that company would be located. Now, if you charter an organization, you find one of the first two things you have to put in that charter is where that company is located. I guess we learned from King Charles. When we chartered this church, we chartered it as Hope Baptist Church. The next part, we had to tell where we were located. They want to know where you are. Well, wasn't anything in this charter about where they were to be located, where they were to hold their meetings, where they were to vote. And that was exactly what they were looking for, because now they had an opportunity to take their own company and move it to America and vote here and decide their company's policy here and enact their company's laws here in this country, away and distanced from the King of England. And the idea was this: we can pull away from England and still remain true, loyal English people. And you're not going to find any shades of seceding from England or throwing off the English crown till, I guess, probably the first is a Baptist preacher by the name of Roger Williams. We'll find out maybe a little bit about him this morning, and not even a lot then. As a matter of fact, most of the men that signed the Declaration of Independence did not want to sign it. They felt compelled to because they had no other choice. There were a few reactionaries. Listen, nobody wanted to cut off that benevolent king halfway across the ocean over there as long as he'd take care of them and help them. We kind of get the idea that everybody in America, you know, voted 100% to break ties with England. England had probably as many loyalists here in the United States as we had the colonists when we broke with England. Now, there were grounds. You talk about the North and the South separating brother against brother. The Revolution separated brother against brother. Ben Franklin, I don't believe, was ever inclined to break from England. I don't think he desired it. I don't believe a lot of those founding fathers desired it. I'm not trying to deride them, for certainly that even proves more of their courage. That when they were forced into a corner, they were willing to do something they did not believe necessarily was in their best interest in order to maintain the religious liberty and the freedom they had found in America. But these people came, they didn't want to break ties with England. Remember, these were Puritans. They wanted to purify the church from within. And so they wanted to maintain loyalty to the crown, the English crown. But the problem was, how could you maintain loyalty to the English crown when the English crown was trying to persecute you? The answer was obvious. You go an ocean away, You establish a colony where you can operate that colony under English rule, but at the same time making your own rules as you go along and still swear allegiance to the English crown. That was the answer. And so the prospect of settling this country in 1628, John Endicott, who was a Puritan, came to this country. He landed in Salem, Massachusetts with 66 men on board to comprise his colony. In 1629, Higginson arrived with 200 more people, just in time, because in 1629, Charles I dissolved the English Parliament and said he would rule the government himself. Became England, of course, was a parliamentary governed body, and Charles said, I'll do the running of it myself. And boy, not much legislation got underneath Charles then. But God had preserved these people. He had allowed their charter to pass just prior to this. They had settled their country. In 1630, John Winthrop comes. And when John Winthrop comes, he finds that of the people that have come, which was 275 plus people, there are only 85 that remain in the colony. Why? They ran into the same thing that all of these other colonies ran into. And that was an extremely difficult lifestyle. So much so that people died. And over half of these people that had come turned back, went back to England. Remember, they were English aristocracy. Remember what we learned at Jamestown from the aristocrats? They didn't want to work. And when these aristocrats came over here and found out they were going to have to work, they were going to have to go pick berries just to live, that was not conducive to their lifestyle. So they sailed back to England. They'd rather be persecuted than have to work. And so they had returned to England, and there were only 85 that remained, and of those 85, the vast majority were preparing to set sail for England. They had given up. They said it wasn't going to be what they wanted. Now, let me read you a couple of ideas here, a couple of thoughts. There's a statement here that said the Puritans had more than the Pilgrims, more money, more servants, more friends in high places, more education, more business experience. They had more of everything. So the Puritans were vastly different than the Pilgrims were. And that's important that you remember that because of what's going to take place here very shortly. And so these people set sail. Here is a statement of John Winthrop. John Winthrop is the last to arrive in 1630 and to command the colony that is established there. John Winthrop is probably the greatest of the early colonists that ever lived. John Winthrop is largely responsible for the form of government and the system that is set up here that eventually spreads to all 13 colonies and brings in the freedom of the United States. Washington is called the father of our country, but I believe more so than that, some of these men here were the fathers of our country. And Winthrop certainly would hold a good place as a candidate for being the father of our country. He wrote a note to clarify why he felt it was necessary that the Puritans leave and abandon England. He said that it would be a service to the church of great consequence to carry the gospel into those parts of the world. His first reason was evangelism. Unlike the other charters that had mentioned evangelism that had never really occurred, he mentioned it first and as a priority for abandoning England. He says, all other churches of Europe are brought to desolation. And who knows but that God hath provided this place to be a refuge for many whom he means to save out of the general calamity. Remember, the Counter-Reformation is going on in Europe. There will be some 70 million people who are Protestants who die in Europe. You won't find any history books giving any account of that. La Rochelle, all right, the seaport bastion in which the French Huguenots had held out for 2 years had just fallen to Cardinal Richelieu. And every one of them are killed. Every Huguenot is destroyed. They held out for 2 years. And the Cardinal Richelieu comes in at the head of the army and kills every French Huguenot there. And in Germany, Wallenstein was pulverizing the armies of the Protestants. I said the other day, I've been to several of those cities, a little city by the name of Fronleiten in Austria, another city by the name of Rotenburg, were all Protestant strongholds where they were trying to hold out. And every one of those Protestants were killed. They were all destroyed. He says, and seeing the church hath no place left to fly but into the wilderness, what better work can there be than to go and provide tabernacles and food for her against that time when she comes thither? Witherspoon was convinced that the Protestants were going to lose in Europe, and they did. And he said, if we don't provide a place for them, all hope is abandoned. And so he came to America. This land grows weary of her inhabitants, so is man, who is most precious of all creatures, is here more vile and base than the earth we tread upon, and of less price among us than a horse or a sheep. All arts and trades are carried in that deceitful and unrighteous course, so it is almost impossible for a good and upright man to maintain his charge and live comfortably on any of them. The fountains of learning and religion are so corrupted, as most children are perverted and corrupted. And on he went with his reasons for breaking with the motherland of England and establishing a homeland here in America. They believed they were going to die. They did not believe they could survive the Holocaust that was coming, and history records came in Europe. The destruction was massive and widespread. When they arrived here, at least when Winthrop arrived here, he found, as I said before, a colony that was falling apart. And he began to deal with Endicott and find out from Endicott what the problem was. You see, there were some inherent problems in these colonies. For some reason, they could not get established. They would die. Endicott had come to this country, as I said, as the first of the Massachusetts Bay Company to settle in the northern part of the country, about 40 miles north of where the Pilgrims were. He had settled in Salem and had gone through that same general sickness, and people had died, and they had almost abandoned all hope. And during that part of time, Endicott had sent down to the Plymouth colony where the Pilgrims were, requesting some help. And when he sent down there, William Bradford, who was the governor of the colony down there, sent Sam Fuller back north, 40 miles, to assist. Sam Fuller was a physician. And Sam Fuller came back and began to treat the Puritans that had settled there in Salem, and their overall morale began to rise a little bit. He began to treat them, they began to get better, and again, they were not out of the woods, as can be seen by the fact that 2 years later, they're all ready to leave. But more importantly than that, Fuller began to become the best friend of Endicott. And Fuller and Endicott began to bounce ideas or begin to share their beliefs one with another. You see, Fuller was a pilgrim, was a separatist. Endicott was a Puritan. Two opposing viewpoints. And yet Fuller was part of a colony that had existed almost 10 years and was beginning to flourish. And Endicott was the governor of a colony that faced starvation. And so Endicott paid particular attention to what Fuller had to say. Remember, most of the Pilgrims were people that lacked education, but not so with Fuller. He was a physician, one of the few that had education. Endicott was part of a group that nearly all were educated, and all were people of prominent means. And there probably would have been no reason for those two peoples ever to have gotten together had it not been for the sickness that invaded the Salem colony. Had it not been for the need of a physician, they probably never would have crossed paths other than perhaps only to antagonize one another. But now the Puritans were helpless. And Sam Fuller came and began to lend a hand. Endicott said concerning him in one place, he never knew a more godly man in all of his life. And Endicott and Fuller began a friendship that is to last, and matter of fact is to increase till that both colonies become friendly, and as a matter of fact begin to share one with another their ideas. Let me give you three things that Sam Fuller helped the Puritans with as they came here. First of all, the first lesson that they learned was that of, in the words of Endicott, compassionate unity. Compassionate unity. They learned that the reason that the Plymouth colony was functioning and was surviving and even flourishing was the fact that everybody worked. and they all cared about each other. Remember, here's a colleton of Puritans represented by English aristocracy who don't believe in work. They're about to face the same fate that Jamestown faced because no one would work. And Fuller comes and begins to explain to Endicott how the Bible teaches that everybody should work, how that none is above work. And when Winthrop shows up, he and Endicott spend time on these, and eventually Winthrop says, every man will work and every woman will work. We are going to all take care of one another. That was the idea that brought that Puritan colony from desolation to the point where in just a few years there's over 1,000 settlers in Salem, and they move on to Boston and found the second of the cities of that colony. And in just a few short years, there are about 20 cities that have been settled in that little area of land up there. Why? They learned something from those pilgrims. And the first thing they learned was compassionate unity. Now, those pilgrims had learned it the hard way as well. Remember when they came, they planted the general crop, and they were to take that crop and to provide food, and they were supposed to work for the fellow back over in England to provide for him. They, after all, they were indentured to him. And after the second year, nobody wanted to plant the crops anymore. Why should they? That's where communism always ends up. Communism is a very noble thought, and there's just one problem with it. It doesn't work. And today, in this day and time, you hear about capitalism and greed, 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 greed. Listen, I believe greed is a sin, but I'm going to tell you something. Without greed, capitalism wouldn't work. It just wouldn't work. You can get all upset with it. I'll tell you why a fellow started General Motors. He wanted to make money. I'll tell you why Kellogg's makes cereal. They wanted to make money. Folks, it's time we got it through our head that the reason we've got it as good as we've got it is because of fellows that wanted to make money. And we now penalize people for having money. We say, well, those big, bad, mean, ugly guys, the rich corporations that control this country. I'd rather have a rich corporation controlling this country any day than Mao Zedong or Joseph Stalin. Any day of the week. Joseph Stalin took over and starved his people to death. Mao Zedong took over and killed his people. You let General Motors run, everybody have a job. We get upset at the corporations. Well, the big guys, they're just greedy, greedy, greedy. So are you. I mean, if you walk down the street today and saw a $50 bill laying alongside the sidewalk, you're going to leave it lay there? I don't think so. You know why? Because you're a greedy rascal. You know, you go pick it up and give it to the first homeless person you see. Amen. I remember that story with two colored fellows years ago walking together, and they began to talk one with another. And it's an ethnic joke, so you have to understand that. But they were walking down the road, and a fellow looked over at the other fellow, and he said, Leroy, he said, me and you good friends. And Leroy said, man, you know me and you's good friends. We've known each other all our lives. And he said, how good friends is we, Leroy? He said, oh, man, we's the best of friends. He said, Leroy, he said, if you had 100 acres of land, he said, would you give me 50? He said, oh, man. He said, you know as good of friends as me and you is, if I had 100 acres of land, I'd give you 50 in a heartbeat. He said, you know as me and you is good friends. They walked down the road a little further, and he said, Leroy, he said, if you had $1,000, he said, would you give me half of it? Leroy said, shut your mouth, man. He said, you know as good of friends as me and you is, if I had $1,000, I'd give you 500 in a minute. They walked a little further. He said, Leroy, he said, if you had two hogs, would you give me one of them? And Leroy said, shut up, man, you know I got two hogs. You know, we're real benevolent with what we don't have. But when push comes to shove, I'm going to tell you something. You're just as greedy as the next fellow is. And I'm going to tell you something. The beautiful thing about capitalism is it channels greed into productivity. Because capitalism says, hey, you want $1 million? Work. You want $1 million? Invent. You want $1 million? Build a factory. You want $1 million? Invest. You want $1 million? Produce. That's the beautiful thing about capitalism. Why? It works. It works. Look around you. Do you know they say 5% of the world enjoy the majority of the world's wealth? America is a rich, rich nation. And I said the other day, well, what about them sheiks over there? And listen, them sheiks over there would still be eating camel steaks if it hadn't been for the ability to come to a capitalistic country and sell their oil. I mean, we think, well, you know, those people over there, they got it just as good. They'd dry up and blow away if it wasn't for America. Their well-being is dependent on America. Capitalism, it works. The pilgrims didn't want to plant their crops. So Bradford and the leaders of the colony said, all right, here's what we'll do. We'll plant the crop that we are under obligation to plant. Once that crop is in the ground, we'll parcel the rest of the cleared land, and each family can raise their own parcel of land. And whatever they produce in that parcel of land is theirs to use in their own well-being, or to trade, or to sell. However they want to use it, it is up to them. And all at once, the Plymouth colony was revitalized, and they planted. Listen, the second Thanksgiving Day was rejoicing over the abundance that they had. Not because of one crop being raised, but because of many crops being raised. The second Thanksgiving this country ever knew was a celebration of capitalism. That's quite a thought. God blessed their capitalistic venture. Those pilgrims now had the wherewithal to trade with Indians themselves. They didn't need to go through a centralized government. They could take what they had raised and go right to the Indian villages and trade themselves for what they needed. They became independent little corporations. God blessed it. But when the Puritans came to America, they still were enhanced by all of the rules of the English aristocracy. You bring somebody to work for you. You are a gentleman. You wear the ruffles on your sleeve, you know, the ruffles around your neck, a little powdered wig and all. I mean, that idea of aristocracy. And while some of our forefathers someday in the future from here are going to appear to be that cast of men, they never were. Jefferson himself said that there are two types of aristocracy. There's an aristocracy that comes just by birth, which is invalid, and then there's an aristocracy that comes through ability. It is an earned aristocracy. It is an aristocracy of respect. And Jefferson believed that our country's presidents ought to come from that group of men. Because of that, he took a lot of blasting. People said, well, he believed in a higher class. Listen, don't you wish we had a fellow in Washington that had earned his respect? Don't you wish we had a fellow in Washington that we all agreed was the best man for the job? It's a little different now when you get down the road. Compassionate unity. They had to all work or they would all die. And so that idea was brought by Fuller and given to the Puritans, and that's probably one of the only reasons the Puritan colony survived. The second one was the separation of civil authority from ecclesiastical authority. And let me say again, briefly as I can, the separation of church and state was a brand new concept in America. There are no English countries that have separation of church and state. There are no countries to the south of us in America that have separation of church and state. America still stands as one of the few countries that admonishes the separation of church and state. You look at England, and England with its church system would have starved to death 200 years ago if it hadn't been for America. You look at Europe, and Europe would have killed itself in World War II if it hadn't been for the Americans. World War II was a war when America pulled everybody else out. Why? Because those same people that were fighting were twined together with an ecclesiastical system that represented both sides of the conflict. I want to ask you a question. How are you going to be a church and represent both sides of an armed conflict? Mediators like we have in Mexico right now, doing a wonderful job mediating, aren't they? The church system that existed in Europe brought Europe to its knees. You'll find wherever there is a church system, without one exception in the history of mankind, wherever there is a link between the church and the government, it always reduces the people to poverty. There is not one exception in all of history. And yet America is moving ever closer to that type of a situation. We've got this NAFTA free trade agreement. Help those people. I'll tell you what happened to those people. The best thing that happened to Mexico is if they kicked their church out of their government. If they'd run a bunch of black-robed communists out of their country and say, get out of here and go back and pray and count your beads and quit running the voting booth, they'd have a better country. He says, that's kind of bigoted. Wait till I read you what Jefferson said. When Fuller came to a group of Puritans. Remember, the Puritans did not break their ties with the Anglican Church. And the Anglican Church believed in a state-supported church. But it was obvious here in America that the government of England was not going to send them any money for clergymen over here or to build churches. So without even thinking about what the situation was going to be like, they had flooded across here to America, and now they arrived at, how are we going to set up our churches? England was certainly not going to appoint bishops to come to this country, and they certainly were not going to allow those people free. What were we going to do? And Fuller, for the first time in Endicott's life, explained to him how Pilgrim Church was run. It had no civil authority backing it. It didn't receive any money from the community by way of taxation. It didn't get its preacher from some higher group that assigned clergymen to different places. And Endicott said, well, where's the power of the church? And he said, it's in the hands of the people. The people in the Pilgrim colony voted together as a body politic and elected their own leadership, and then submitted to that leadership. That's a startlingly amazing idea that these Puritans face. They never heard of that before. The people actually elected their own preachers, and then they supported them themselves. And no church was responsible by means of civil law to help another church. If they chose to, it was out of benevolence. If they chose to, it was out of a heart of charity. They were not required by civil law to help or assist another church or another congregation. They were independent. I said, why are you an independent Baptist? I'm an American. The first churches that produced anything in this country, they weren't Baptist churches, but they were independent churches. The idea of an independent, separate civil authority from ecclesiastical authority. Now, the remarkable thing about that term has been used in America to mean that the church has no position at all in government. This idea of the separation of church and state, by the way, that term does not occur. Separation of church and state does not occur in any founding document of this nation. It's not there. You say, wait a minute, what about the Second Amendment? We'll look at the Second Amendment before we're done, but the wording of the Second Amendment does not say separation of church and state. It says Congress doesn't pick on the church. That's what it says. What was to be the result? The Puritans had one idea of government. The Pilgrims at Plymouth had another. Who was to be right? Well, Endicott was open to anything because his colony was failing and failing miserably. How do we separate these things? And the idea is this. The state does not sponsor the church. That's what took place. Listen, to this day, if you're born in Italy, you pay income taxes, and every year a percentage of your tax money goes to support the Vatican. Whether you like it or not. You say, well, those people over there like you. You're crazy. 94% of the Italian people go to church twice a year. And 54% of the Italian population profess atheism. In England, it's 94% that profess atheism. But in England, they pay a tax to the Anglican Church. In Italy, they pay a tax to the Vatican. In Germany, they pay a tax to the Lutheran Church. In Greece, they pay a tax to the Greek Orthodox Church. In America, you don't have to pay tax to any church. That's what they meant by the separation of church and state. The state did not sponsor the church. You say, well, how can the church make it? How can the church live? What can the... I've had people ask me, said, how do you guys get enough money to exist? Look around. This is it. Somebody asked one time, well, did the convention send you any money when you bought this new building? I said, what convention? There ain't any convention. Nobody backs us. Nobody signs their name on the bottom line. Nobody says we'll stand behind these people in good faith. This is all of Hope Baptist Church there is. You say, how do you exist? You know, when we went to the bank to refinance our building about 2 years ago, you know what the banker said? He took our financial statements. He called me on the phone. He said, preacher, how much money do you want? I could call that bank today. I'm confident right now. I'd call that bank right now and get $300,000 this afternoon if I needed it. You say, what kind of clout have we got? We've got the highest per capita giving record of any church in Northwest Ohio right here. They called me in and introduced me to the board of directors. And they said, preacher, how do you guys do this? I said, we just teach giving. We just teach giving. That's all you got to do. They said, you got any rich people in your church? I said, to my knowledge, I don't have any rich people in my church. We just believe in giving. You see, America, our churches, have always been afraid of this idea of an independent church. How can you make it? I got news for you. If you're not worth your salt, you ought not to make it. I can think of a lot of churches that ought to be bankrupt. The only reason they exist right now is because somebody's funneling money into them. They got nothing. Civil authority, distinct from ecclesiastical and congregational rule of the church. In other words, when they had a problem in the church, they didn't have to appeal to the bishop or the archbishop. Or when they had a problem in the church, they hashed it out for themselves right there in the church, and they voted and changed or amended whatever needed to be done, and that was it, fixed. You know, when you eliminate that ecclesiastical hierarchy, you eliminate about 90% of the corruption in any religious group. For instance, money that comes in here to go to missions. You know how much of it goes to missions? It all goes to missions. You know, the Southern Baptist Convention, I heard the statistics the other day, they tell me that $4 out of every $100 given to the Southern Baptist Convention Cooperative Program, which is their missions movement, $4 out of every 100 gets to the missionary. What are you saying, preacher? I'm saying you eliminate that hierarchy and you eliminate 90% of the graft and the corruption. People say, well, those are the godly people. Those are the people in league with the devil, as far as I'm concerned. Vicars of Christ, emissaries of God. No, money-hungry, money-grubbing thieves. You put a dollar in the offering plate here, that dollar goes to where it's supposed to get to. We don't send it. We send it right to the missionary. It goes right in his account. Matter of fact, we handle several accounts right here for missionaries. And when money comes in here earmarked for those missionaries, guess what? It doesn't. It goes into their account. We don't sit back and say, well, you know, man, they made a lot of money last month. And we're having a hard time paying a light bill. Let's just take a little of their money and pay. No, it's not our money. It's not ours to do with. We believe in what we call an autonomous body of believers, and that means self-governing. Self-governing. when we need to get a parking lot done, we don't have to call Washington. We don't have to call the archdiocese. We don't have to call the convention headquarters and say, you know, we got some potholes out here. We'd sure like to get a little help doing this parking lot. We just get up and say, folks, we need to do the parking lot. And some people stand up and say, well, I'll help, and it gets done. What is that? That's autonomy. We haven't got anybody else to fall back on. What are you saying, preacher? I'm saying those are the rules that were governing the Plymouth colony. And when Fuller came to deal with Endicott and then Endicott dealt with Winthrop, those were the ideas that were grasped by this new colony of Puritans up there that even more isolated them from England, because now they had a different church system than the system they were trying to uphold in England. But now they begin to make some changes. I read all this last week. Let's move into some new areas. Let me give you this morning six things that became focal points of the Puritan colony. Some of them we've already dealt with, so we'll just breeze over them. Six things that became focal points of the establishing of that colony there in Salem. Now, when I mention Salem, what immediately goes through your mind? Well, witches. Witches burned at the stake. Anybody know how many witches were burned in Salem? Huh? How many witches were burned in Salem? Well, I thought you people went to school. I thought they told you how terrible it was at Salem. Didn't they tell you how many witches were burned in Salem? There were less than 20. You know how many were killed in Europe during the Counter-Reformation? About 40,000 were accused of witchcraft and burned in Europe. I bet they didn't tell you that in school, did they? See, it's different as to who's running the burning. If it's the Puritans, oh, terrible people. If it's the papacy, we're protecting the church. Blood doesn't count. Less than 20 witches died in Salem. What went on in Salem? When I talk about puritanical ideals, what do you think? You see how if you can manipulate a language, you can manipulate a people. When we want to say somebody's too strict, we say they're just puritanical. You hear the bias against the Puritans? This country would not exist. Any historian will acknowledge that, whether he appreciates it or not. Any historian will admit this country would not exist without the influence of the Puritan people. And yet there's a bias in history, there's a bias even in the language itself against the people that established our country. We say, well, that's just puritanical thoughts. What does that mean? Let me tell you what the Puritans were all about. Number one, the Puritans looked at their community as a family. After Fuller got finished and Endicott and Winthrop went to the people and began to develop this colony, which again in just a few years was going to exceed 1,000 people. Further colonization were going to be done with the establishment of Boston and other cities in the New England area by these Puritans. When they became established in what they were all about, number one, they looked at their community as a family. Everybody together. Kind of like we think of our church here. They looked at community as a family. They also looked at family then as a small community. Say, why is that important? I believe it was Cotton Mather that said, a well-ordered families naturally produce a good order in society. They believed that each was responsible to his neighbor, but in turn they believed that the greatest accomplishment they could do was to raise their family with the right outlook on life and the right ideals in their hearts. They were very, very strong family-oriented group of people. Secondly, the principle they adhered to was the despising of sin anywhere it occurred. Foremost in themselves, They despised sin. Their first magistrates used as their law book the Bible. It was the only book they had, book of law they had. They used the Bible. They were strict and they enacted laws that even removed temptations. See, we look at them as puritanical. They had laws such as a law that prohibited young people from being out at night. We call them curfews now. I mean, it's real puritanical, boy, to have curfews, isn't it? But it's amazing when you start getting people shot on the streets how quickly Toledo goes back to a curfew. Why? Why did the pilgrims do it? Because the pilgrims didn't want to drive by shootings. They didn't want people robbing and raping and pillaging. No. The pilgrims didn't want their children to get into a place where they would be tempted to do wrong in the first place. It was an attempt to remove temptation from their lives. Many of the laws they enacted now, we call them blue laws. And we chuckle and laugh at them. Those laws were enacted to keep people from being tempted to sin. You see, the Puritans so despised sin that they didn't want you to get involved in it in the first place. Their laws were improvised so that if a person repented of his sin and acknowledged his wrong, most of the time he was let off. It's amazing when this country was founded, you know how many death penalty infractions there were? There were three. Three reasons. I think today there are probably over 100. Fellow said one time, isn't it amazing that we enact every year thousands of laws just to enforce 10 commandments and still can't do it? The problem is not the law, the problem is the book. They despised sin. They were desirous of repentance. Many, many accounts are given where people were called into court. You know, they could even be put in court for lying. Can you imagine those silly Puritans? They believe the guy should be punished for lying. Unscrupulous business dealings. As a matter of fact, a guy got in trouble one time for winking at a gal in a barn where they were having a meal. And they was ready to take the guy and put him in jail until they found out that the people up above was knocking hay down on him, and he had hay in his eyes, and he was blinking his eyes because he had hay in his eyes. By the way, that's another point. The Puritans were one of the most fun-loving people that you'll ever find. And history does not paint them that way. History paints them as some gruff, rough exterior group of people. Never had any fun. I won't be able to finish all these, so I'll finish them next week, but I'll give you a little story before we close. The Puritans loved God so much and didn't want their lives to become drawn away after the things of this world that they hired a man to work in their services. He was called a tithing man, was his title. This was not somebody the preacher nominated to keep people awake. The church itself got together and hired one of their own, and his sole purpose was to ensure that they did not fall asleep. Again, this wasn't a preacher's idea. But see, they had a little different idea back then. They said it was not unusual for a preacher's sermon to have 30 points. Glory to God. The tithing man's job was to keep everybody awake, and his job was also to turn a big hourglass that stood at the front of the church. It ran an hour, and his job was to turn it over. And they felt that any preacher that could not go at least 2.5 to 3 turns of the hourglass was not worthy to be their pastor. Their idea was we wouldn't have a horse that couldn't run the track. We wouldn't have a horse that couldn't plow the field. Why should we have a preacher that can't preach less than 3 hours? And so the tithing man would come up and turn the hourglass, and the preacher would preach for 3 hours on Sunday morning. And the tithing man would move. Let me see if I can find this little story. This is kind of comical here. Here we go. This guy's name was Obadiah Turner, and he kept an account, 1646, in his diary, and he talked about the tithing man. It says, as he strutted about the meeting house, he did spy Mr. Tomlins sleeping with much comfort, his head kept steady by being in the corner and his hand grasping the rail. And so spying, Allen did quickly thrust his staff behind Dame Ballard and give him a grievous prick upon the hand. Whereupon Mr. Tomlins did spring up much above the floor, and with terrible force did strike his head against the wall, and also, to the great wonder of all, did profanely exclaim, "Curse ye woodchuck," he dreaming, so it seemed, that a woodchuck had seized and bit his hand. But on coming to know where he was and the great scandal he had committed, he seemed much abashed, but did not speak, and I think he will not soon again go to sleep in the meeting. These people were comical. They enjoyed a good laugh. They appreciated humor. But they loved God. And they found it.